From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk about innovation in the engineering fields with Marquette University's Opus Dean of Engineering, Dr. Christina Rapella.
Innovation really happens when you go out of that comfort zone and try new things that you hadn't thought about, and you all of a sudden see things differently, and you see that people have all kinds of different lenses on the world.
Then, a Wausau native's new book is about the food and drink people on the Titanic consumed before it sank.
Those stories of hope and resilience, I think that's why the Titanic story is still alive today.
And longtime friends of Lake Effect musicians Willie Porter and Greg Koch come together to spread awareness and hope in the face of overcoming addiction.
So your own personal evolution towards being more honest with yourself and more accountable to those you care about is really what it's about for me. So I try to just walk that. And, you know, this is probably the most I've ever talked about it.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. Engineering touches everything. From our cars to our smartphones to putting humans in space, engineers make it happen. But sometimes it seems that products or designs aren't completely thought through before they come to the market. Our first guest, Dr. Christina Rapella, wants to ensure the current and next generations of engineers are thinking about innovative and inclusive ways to solve our problems. Dr. Rapella, who goes by Chris, is a biomedical engineer, and she's also the dean of the Opus College of Engineering at Marquette University. She joins me in the studio now. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you for having me here.
I was so fascinated by your bio that came across my desk in a press release for something else that you were doing that I thought, I want to talk to this woman.
Well, thank you.
And I want to talk to you because innovation is a word that gets bandied about a lot. Mm-hmm. We hear it all the time. Everything has to be innovative. Business needs to be innovative. Our own industry here, radio and media, need to be innovative. For you, as someone who sort of specializes in that, what does innovation mean to you? How do you define it for your students at Marquette?
Thank you. It's a great question, and you're right. It's a word that's thrown around a lot, and there are many different people who have written books on it and have their own definition. But for me, I see it in the broadest terms of innovation is about seeing things differently. It is about connecting what we often think of as disconnected or unconnected and doing it in a way that creates value, right? So you're thinking of things differently, applying things differently, bringing things together that you hadn't seen as being connected before, and doing it in such a way that it really creates value for an organization, for people, for the world.
And it doesn't have to be monetary value. It can be all kinds of different values.
Absolutely not. We talk about not just financial value, but their, you know, societal values, values to the way people live their life, really just making the world a better place. And there are many ways of doing that.
And so when you talk to your students about this, what are some of the ways that you encourage thinking differently? How do you get them to piece those things together?
Well, I think there are multiple ways of doing that. One is go hang out with people who are different from yourself, different in their discipline, their major, their ethnicity, their nationality, where they hang out. You know, you might hang out in coffee shops. Other people are out, you know, hiking, biking, whatever. Go hang out with people who are different from yourself. Talk to them, learn their stories, learn about their history, where they come from. Try different activities. Do things you hadn't done before. Go out and try something you didn't do before, whether it's a sport, whether it's, you know, a particular hobby, or maybe it's go visit a place that you haven't been to before. Really kind of putting yourself out of your comfort zone. I think that's often the problem is we tend to get settled in things that we're comfortable with. And really,
that we know.
That's right.
Yeah.
Innovation really happens when you go out of that comfort zone and try new things that you hadn't thought about and are encouraged to do that you all of a sudden see things differently. And you see that people have all kinds of different lenses on the world.
Engineering is one of those disciplines that needs to have that because you pull in so many different threads. There's so much that engineers have their hands on in the world. And I was just thinking about, there was a Guardian article about a month or so ago talking about how the world has been engineered for men. And I literally mean it in an engineering way, like chairs and table heights and, you know, protective vests.
Mm-hmm. Airbags.
Airbags. All these things. Cars, you know, that it's not, you know, for shorter women in particular, it's very unsafe, the position you have to be in. And so are those kinds of things what you're working on at Marquette, trying to get people to think about not just solving the problem of, like, we need airbags to work, right, but we need them to work for an entire range of population?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think you can think of any one thing that engineering doesn't touch, whether it's our roadways, it's our cell phones, it is the way we design a syringe and a needle used in medical environments, surgical techniques, cars, airplanes. We touch everything, right, as engineers. But for too long, we often designed it exactly maybe for a male, right? You know, even when the National Institutes of Health used to do a lot of research, it was based on the male and maybe even the white male kind of thing. And so we know much better that that doesn't work well. That's why airbags were, you know, there's injuries to children and women because of that. And so what we're doing now is trying to help our students think there's a much bigger world out there and you need to design around all these different types of people and cultures and that kind of thing. For example, we have a student organization that's involved in Engineers Without Borders, right? And so they're going to countries in Latin America and helping to develop water systems or adding electricity to villages. And it's not okay to just take our technologies in the U.S. and take it to those places. It doesn't often work that way. You need to go and experience life and those cultures and find out what those people want in terms of what they consider good for their own societies and their own cultures, and then help to engineer within that context. And so we giving our students those kinds of experiences, having our, let's say, biomedical engineers go out into a medical clinic and watch how a patient experiences their healthcare, watch nurses and physical therapists and doctors actually work, as opposed to you sitting in your cubicle, never walking those floors and thinking you're designing some great technology for them that oftentimes sits on a shelf because you didn't take the time to look at the customer.
The idea was great, but the actual execution didn't work.
Right, and I learned that when I was in college. I did a couple summer internships with Marquette Electronics, which was Mike Cudahy's company. And one of the most valuable things I learned from that was you better know your customer and just walk the floors and observe what's going on, because you can engineer a really great patient monitor that the brains are real sophisticated and smart, and yet you will find out that no one touches it. And, you know, there were all these buttons on the monitor, and the only button that a nurse ever touched was alarms on, alarms off. And most of the time it was off and not even doing what it was supposed to do because it wasn't designed in a way that was friendly to the user, friendly to the customer.
It's almost like engineers also need a degree in anthropology and and social sciences, because mm-hmm. you need to understand human behavior so thoroughly in order to create products that work.
You're right. And that's why at Marquette we have this thing called the core curriculum and why the humanities are so important. It is important to understand that your technology is not used in isolation, right? That all these other human factors, cultural factors, economic factors, all impact your work and whether or not your invention, your technology is ever going to be used, whether it's going to be successful. And so that is why we have this core curriculum and the humanities, to inform our students to be critically thinking in this greater world of not just technology, but all the other things that influence your work as an engineer. And so we're very passionate about that. It's also important if we want our students to go out and be leaders. You know, the Jesuits are, everybody's a leader. So we want them to be leaders in their fields, in their communities, in their schools, whatever it might be. And so you need to have that really rich, well-rounded education in order to think critically in a very complex world.
You are a woman heading an engineering school, and that is rare. Mm-hmm. And so just having you in that position should be shifting some thinking, even if it's not conscious thinking, I would hope.
Yes, I think it does. I'm very big on culture and how important that is to an organization. And, you know, this idea that culture eats strategy for lunch, and that we can have all kinds of great ideas as a college, whether it's education, our research, the way we serve the world. But if we don't have a good culture within our college and the way that we look at people, respect their differences, respect the gifts they bring to our community, we aren't going to get very far. And so in my first, you know, 3-4 years as a dean, I've worked a lot on thinking about our culture within engineering and how we behave as a team, how we behave as a college, how we interface with the world and how we're preparing our graduates for that world. And I hope it's made a difference, I think, in terms of appreciating diverse perspectives. How do we have adult difficult conversations? How do we appreciate each other's gifts? How do we celebrate our successes and really make people feel like they're every person in the college, our students, our staff, our faculty, that every single person is a leader in our college. They all are expected to be leaders, and they're also expected to be contributing to that mission.
I assume you're also trying to recruit people into the school who don't fit the stereotyped idea of who an engineer is.
Yeah, and those stereotypes are real, and they're often deserved because, as I say, for decades, we had people who fit those stereotypes just kept recruiting and employing people just like themselves because that was very comfortable. But we need to get out of that. And that's men and women alike. It's not just women, but there are men who see those stereotypes and are put off by it as well. And it's a shame because if we're going to be truly innovative, we need to represent people from all walks of life. If we're going to serve the world, we need to look more like the world we serve, right? And so we need to do a better job of bringing down those stereotypes and welcoming different types of people. So, for example, we're doing a lot to bring in first-generation students, often from lower economic backgrounds, and so that requires scholarship funds. And so we're working really hard to raise scholarship to allow these students the opportunity of an education that will give them the kind of future that they dream of. So we're working hard on that. We work on STEM outreach activities. So some of our student organizations, as well as our faculty, are getting out into middle schools and high schools, particularly in the urban environments here, and giving some of those students exposure to what are the STEM fields, what is an engineering career like, how important might my work be to making the world better and my own community better. So we do that. And then we have programs like our ELEAD program. I truly believe if you want more women and underrepresented groups in engineering, they want to see the opportunity for leadership, that maybe they're not just going to sit in a cubicle the rest of their life and punch out something on a computer, but they're going to lead people, work with people, be able to take organizations to a different place. And so we created ELEAD, which stands for Engineers in the Lead, and it's a 3-year undergraduate curriculum for engineering students to help them develop their leadership acumen and think about how they are going to be leaders someday in their organizations, not right away. And they learn that leadership is not about a title in any way, but how do I do better leading people through change and working with teams of people?
I was going to say, I would imagine the STEM, you mentioned going into middle schools, and the idea, there's been a lot of emphasis on STEM education starting in grade school and going through high school. Are you seeing the students that you are recruiting from some of the underserved populations? Are people well prepared, or do they need remedial work in STEM fields?
We often see both. Absolutely, we're seeing students, some of these underrepresented students from here in the urban environment who are very well prepared. They're getting what they need out of the schools. The schools have made a real commitment to developing particularly their math and science skills and their interest, but also their ability to write and read. I mean, that's all important, very important to it as well. And they are doing it. Other students haven't had that opportunity. Maybe because of their local schools or neighborhoods, they aren't given that opportunity. And so they often do need some sort of remedial to kind of bring them up to speed where they can be. Sometimes that is served well by some of our trade and tech schools in the area that can bring them up to speed for where we need them to be. We offer some, you know, remediation type courses, and some of the courses we have, we don't often have enough of that, and that's something we think about. So we find it is effective to work with the teachers in these high schools and middle schools to help them do a better job of preparing these students and maybe help assist them with what they're doing in their classrooms and their laboratories to appreciate just where the students need to be in order to be successful when they get to a college environment.
And then, of course, become successful engineers once they graduate.
Right. Yeah. And I also want to comment that it's been great that there's, in the last decade or so, there's been more of an emphasis on teaching STEM, getting students excited about STEM in their middle school and high school years, and it's good. And oftentimes, you know, part of the problem is just not having teachers who, I mean, if you haven't practiced as an engineer, it's hard to talk about excitedly if you've never done it, right? But yet there are teachers who are trying to do that through programs like Project Lead the Way and some of those sorts of things, which is great. And I'm glad there's so much more. And the word engineering is much more commonplace in schools, K-12 schools, and amongst teachers and stuff. But sometimes I worry that we maybe swing too far. So if schools only specialize in STEM and only want to be STEM academies, don't give up on the other parts of education. I'm a big advocate for music and art and what that brings to an engineering student as well, because that's really important to creativity. Again, having different lenses on problems, to be creative, to be innovative. And sometimes I'm worried we're losing that. And I'm a big proponent of be well-rounded as long as you can. Don't shut doors too early. And if you look at a lot of our engineering students, they're in the choirs, they're in the bands, they're in the orchestras. They do different types of art, and they, you know, they have all these other things, and they do dance, and so I would not want to see sort of the fine arts eliminated because we want to put so much emphasis on just STEM.
Right. They're interdisciplinary,
yes.
And they really have to be.
Yes.
I mean, the true sense of a liberal arts education included math and science mm-hmm. and art and literature. It was that well-rounded idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're also a researcher yourself. Do you get any time to do the kind of stuff that you love to do in the lab for yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. Not as much since I stepped into the dean's role. It's much harder because of all the other demands on the job. I used to do a lot of work in more general terms of what we call signal processing, where you're taking measures of things going on in the body. For me, it started with signals that are generated by the heart electrical signals and how we use that to diagnose if the heart is functioning properly or not. And when it's not, how do we use our technologies like pacemakers and defibrillators to make change? And then I moved into brain imaging research where we were looking at particularly what we call functional magnetic resonance brain imaging, where we can actually look at brain function while people are performing tasks, map that to certain areas of the brain and be able to use that, let's say, for pre-surgical planning or to look at recovery after stroke and those sorts of things. So a lot of fun, and it really was sort of the early days of artificial intelligence where you're developing medical devices to automatically detect and diagnose things going on in the body. So very, very fun. I did it for a long time. Since I've been dean, it's been harder to do that. I don't have as much time as I'd like to have for graduate students who are a big part of helping in the lab and helping research. But I stay in touch in a different way now. My job now is to really know the research of all the faculty in the college. And so I spent a lot of time learning about what's going on in their laboratories and what kind of research they're doing and how do I help them secure funding for that. And whether it's from donors, government agencies, foundations, I have to be able to talk intelligently about their research so that I can tell other people about the good work as we look for resources, funds, new faculty, graduate students. So I see my role is to really support the research of others, and that keeps me intellectually engaged in many, many ways, having to know now about research across environmental engineering, civil engineering, mechanical engineering, biomedical, electrical. And the beauty of that is I also get to see the interdisciplinary nature of that, and also what are some, and that helps me to be innovative because it's like, hey, did you know this person environmental is working on something that you're interested in mechanical, and you could bring those fields together. So I feel like the greatest joy in my job has always been, how do I bring people from different disciplines and fields together to work together in a team to do something new? And I get to do a lot more of that as a dean now and also find the resources to support those kind of multidisciplinary efforts.
And then you get to also champion people that are doing fabulous work.
Right. And I love doing that, right?
Yeah,
that's a great thing. It's so exciting. We have some great young faculty and new faculty, and seeing some of the things that they're doing and the impact they're having on the world is just really a joy to be able to support them.
Dr. Christina Rapella is the Opus Dean of the Opus College of Engineering, and she's a professor of biomedical engineering as well at Marquette University. You can find out more about her and about the school from a link at wuwm.com. We'll take a quick break, and then a Wisconsin woman goes in search of an underexplored part of Titanic history. We'll hear about her results when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. 107 years after it sank, it is hard to believe that there's any aspect to the tragic voyage of the Titanic that we don't know much about. The supposedly unsinkable ship hit an iceberg and went down in the North Atlantic in April of 1912. But a recent book by a Wausau native takes an unusual approach to the Titanic's history. Veronica Hinkey's book is called The Last Night on the Titanic: Unsinkable Drinking, Dining, and Style. It explores the food and drinks passengers consumed on the ill-fated journey. The book weaves recipes from the time into the narrative and uncovers some Wisconsin connections. Hinkey spoke with Lake Effect intern Zoe Munson back in April about her research and why she thinks the story of the Titanic still interests people so much.
Well, it is still so relevant because it helps us understand why we are the way we are today. The foods and the drinks that we consume today are so tied to our history. That's why I wanted to look back at what were they eating and drinking aboard the Titanic. And we were able to do that, Zoe, by looking at the many different menus and the letters that were written home. People tucked menus into their pockets as they were leaving the ship. 107 years ago this week, many of those were being shared with family members as survivors told of their stories. And we were able to see so much of what life was like then by looking at those. And shortly after the Titanic was when World War One started. And World War One really changed the class divide forever, or at least as much as we've known thus far. Up until that time, though, there were very distinct class differences, so much so that in steerage or third class, for instance, you know, the main meal of the day was midday. That's when they ate their heavy beef and brown gravy, whereas in other classes, all of the meals were very fully opulent and extravagant. So we see that difference there. And of course, we see very clear distinctions in the ingredients and the food, you know, versus brown gravy and beef. In first class, we see, you know, the punch romaine that is still so celebrated today, the palate cleanser that was one of the 10 courses served on that last night on the Titanic. So there are glimpses of what life was like. In addition to the menus and letters, I looked at restaurants that were popular at the time, around 1912. So then we were able to tell what those people that were aboard the Titanic would have likely been eating based on, you know, what they would have been eating at a restaurant, like Delmonico's, where I had my book launch party in New York City. You know, we were able to look at those things and see what someone like John Jacob Astor IV might have been eating.
Exactly. So a lot of your book is obviously focused on the tragedy of the Titanic, but it's kind of a different spin, especially since you are a food writer. So I kind of mentioned, and you kind of mentioned, how your book is different from a typical nonfiction story in a variety of ways, I'll say, but could you explain what a culinary narrative is or why you chose to go about writing this story in that way?
Well, it's a culinary narrative because it's stories of these people with ties to food and people who snuggled away menus and so forth and wrote letters. And it's where it's appropriate and fitting, we have recipes sprinkled in. And so it's a culinary narrative because it's about those foods and other foods as well. The recipes, of course, are not the originals from the Titanic chefs. So what people have done throughout the years, chefs and home cooks have recreated as close to what they think the actual meals might have been made like. And in some instances, they're very much inspired only. For instance, with the English spring pea soup, we included a beautiful recipe for that by Michael Lashowitz in Winnetka, Illinois. And we included that because the soup wasn't served aboard the Titanic, but there were spring peas that were ubiquitous, especially in first class. Anything that shouted out spring, we wanted to highlight in the book because it was such a spring-focused menu. So many chefs and home cooks, as they've tried to recreate those last meals aboard the Titanic, they've taken some liberties with, and that's not why Michael developed this recipe, but we've included it in the book, taking a little liberty with that, with, you know, what can we do with these ingredients today? What would help modernize these ingredients?
Right. So you mentioned a few dishes. Is there a favorite dish either for the people who were on the ship or a favorite dish or drink that you wrote about in this book?
Well, yes, I have many favorites myself, and the one that I'd like to highlight to you is actually a crew menu item, and it was on April 2nd during the crew sea trials, and then the crew had a beautiful lunch afterward and on board, and actually the very first meal ever served aboard the Titanic was a crew meal during those April 2nd sea trials, and the item that I loved so much was plover. It was a seabird that was carefully chosen for that menu as a way, I believe, probably, of honoring these people who had chosen to dedicate their lives to the sea. It was just a really neat, very thoughtfully planned out menu, and you can see that in that menu item. It was clover and a little bit of toast. And I thought, how lovely, and what a thoughtful menu.
Right. So growing up a Wisconsinite myself, I heard the story of the Titanic as one of the greatest tragedies in history, of course, but I never really heard the story in reference to Wisconsin history. Is there a lesser-known connection there with either the simple facts of the story or the food as you focus?
Zoe, 107 years ago today, a letter arrived at 50 Pineapple Street in Brooklyn, New York, and that is where Merrill, Wisconsin native H.V. Kaltenborn lived. And the letter was written to him by a Titanic passenger, also from Merrill, Wisconsin. The letter had been written by Popcorn Dan, Dan Coxman, a popcorn vendor in Merrill, and also a caretaker at one time at the T.B. Scott Mansion, overlooking the Wisconsin River. And the letter said to H.V., who was at that time the dramatics editor at the Brooklyn Daily Eagle and went on to become what many have considered to be sort of the Walter Cronkite of radio during the 1930s especially. And the letter said, I'm coming to meet you and spend time with you in Brooklyn on my way back to Merrill, Wisconsin. And I would love it if you could meet me at Chelsea Piers when the ship comes in, and I'm coming on the Titanic. He was so excited. Dan Coxman wrote this letter, so excited to plan on meeting H.V. Kaltenborn, two Merrill natives that were meeting up. And then Dan was going to continue on to Merrill. He had gone to London, where he was from. He grew up in the northern part of London, and he had gone back to visit his family. And he had gone out and bought all sorts of beautiful clothes from Harry Crumb Clothers in Merrill. And those were the things that he wanted to be wearing, a fur coat and beautiful suit to meet his family. And then on the way back on the Titanic was, you know, when he lost his life. And we don't know what happened to him. There were several mentions of him in newspapers throughout Wisconsin shortly after the disaster. But it was on this day, April 17th, when H.V. opened the letter and he went running in immediately the next morning to his editor to say, look, I've received a letter from a Titanic passenger. And at this point, during this week, 107 years ago, the newspapers were just all about the Titanic disaster. Every headline, this disaster just completely dominated. And so they ran the letter in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle the next day. Dan was going to London to try to find out about how to bring what would have been Central Wisconsin's one of the very first movie theaters. He really loved entertaining people, and he was very beloved throughout Merrill. He had a cart that was a red and yellow, brightly colored crater popcorn wagon. It was pulled by a white horse. He just had that one horse. And one thing that I thought was interesting was to note through the probate notes that I read about Dan, he owned very few items, but one item he owned that seemed to be his pride and joy because of the great expense, was a stove range that was top of the line at the time. So you could see that he really prioritized his budget around culinary, things that he could, you know, cook with. And I thought that was really neat.
Especially that connection there with that culinary aspect, as you just mentioned. So I'm sure that was a very interesting portion of the book to learn about and to write about. But what was maybe your favorite part about writing this book?
My favorite part about writing this book was the inspiration that I gained. And it was a total surprise to me. I had lost my mother suddenly about a year ago. She lived in Marathon, Wisconsin, and had lived for many years in Wausau. And she died very suddenly. She was in perfect health. And then a few months later, I learned I had triple negative breast cancer. And I had to complete this book. I was on a very tight deadline at that point. I really wanted this to happen in time for this anniversary this week. And a friend reminded me that, you know, when I was sitting down after work every night throughout every weekend, skimming through these horrible stories of these people that had survived this disaster and many who did not. And it was so much emotional work. those stories that I was reading about these amazing heroes were actually keeping me lifted through some of the most challenging times in my life. And I was very surprised by that.
I'm very glad you wrote this book and finished this book. Are you planning on working with the Titanic again in the future?
Well, I sure would love to. Right now, I'm so focused on the launch that the book that I'm really not looking at that right now. But of course, I sure would love to do more outreach about it. And again, it's because of the people. And it's not uncommon for that to happen with food writing. You know, every food story I've ever written, always at the core of each one, it always ended up being about the people in each story I've done. And that doesn't seem to change. This book is no different. This book talks about the ice cream maker from Inwil, Switzerland, and how he told his parents, after I complete this crossing on the Titanic, I will be able to get any job in culinary in any of the best hotels in London. And he lost his life. He was not able to survive. And, you know, those stories of hope and resilience, I think that's why the Titanic story is still alive today.
Definitely. Do you have anything you would like to add?
Well, I just want to add that I really appreciate you helping to get the message out about the book and the importance of the stories of these incredible people. And I sincerely hope that readers will find as much inspiration and, you know, empowerment through these stories as I did in researching and writing them.
Wausau native Veronica Hinkey's new book is called The Last Night on the Titanic, Unsinkable Drinking, Dining, and Style. She spoke with Lake Effect Zoe Munson by phone from Chicago, and our interview with her first aired in April. We'll take one last break, and then musicians Willie Porter and Greg Koch, who are no strangers to Lake Effect, come together on stage and in our studio for a good cause. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Addiction issues, from alcohol to the misuse of opioids, is a national crisis. In 2017, more than 900 people died from opioid overdoses in Wisconsin alone. And in 2019, seeing little significant change in the rate of addiction here, a new organization called WisHope began providing resources, education, and support to Wisconsin communities and individuals who are impacted by addiction and mental health issues. The organization uses a whole community approach that seeks to connect people with local health resources across the state through peer-to-peer counseling and a one-stop website. Peter Brunzel is the executive director at WisHope, and he was joined in the Lake Effect Performance Studio by musicians Willie Porter and Greg Koch, who perform at the first Hope Festival this Saturday. They all spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the organization's mission and the upcoming festival. But first, let's enjoy a little Koch and Porter guitar fun.
Excellent. That was Willie Porter and Greg Koch right here in the Lake Effect studio. Two longtime musician friends of Lake Effect. Thank you for being here today.
Pleasure.
And also joining Willie and Greg, we have Peter Brunzel, the executive director of WisHope. So thank you all for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Peter, so you are the executive at WisHope. So to start, why don't you just give us a little overview of the foundation and why you started it?
Sure. One of the things that we run into quite often is people looking for care and where to go. So whether you're in Eagle River, Wisconsin, La Crosse, Milwaukee, Madison, there's a lot of confusion sometimes if you're a family member or even yourself looking, where do you go? What do? And how can you have a local resource help you guide? So we set up the phone line of 844-WIS-HOPE so people can simply give a call. And if they want support as well, just to have a conversation, we're there for them too. And we train the person on the other end of the phone to be a peer. And so it's a peer-directed organization that way. And then they can also go on the website and be able to peruse all the resources that we've collected throughout a map on the website there, and they can see what's in their area and what we verified that's available for them.
So can you go into the peer directed aspect a little bit? So is this primarily for various age groups? Are you looking to address the needs and problems of the younger demographics facing problems with opioid and other addiction?
Sure. Demographics will serve anybody as far as any demographic for the age. But what we try to do is have people with lived experience be taking part in the connection and making that connection to somebody. If they just want to have a connect to a peer and have that be their process, or going to community services or some sort of clinical or medical services.
How do you think this is a better way to address this epidemic compared to, say, quote, more traditional ways of treatment that have been in existence, you know, to have this different community approach?
Yeah. I don't think it's per se better. I think that sometimes we're not always gathering all the pieces that are needed to support a human, right? And whatever crisis is going on in their life. And this is just one of those pieces that wasn't being focused on for a very long time. So how can we gather the forces and bring people together that have that foundation in their own recovery and train them and have them on the front lines to help people looking for recovery?
So what did you see in your life that motivated you and inspired you to take this kind of initiative?
Sure. I myself am in recovery, and I started my recovery when I was 18 in 1994. Seems like forever ago now.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And so I was a product of the system, and I was a ward of the state when I was 14 years old, and moved through the system in many different ways, and ended up finding my recovery. Well, I got to serve a couple years in our county jail in Waukesha County, and found that maybe there's another way. And even as a youth, I thought, man, how could I help? But it took a lot of growing up before I was able to step to the front line and be able to be that person, to be able to help other people.
And with Hope, Willie, before we brought you in here today, you know, you said you're excited to be part of something that's, quote, recovery geared for everybody. So how do all three of you see this upcoming festival and music as a way to celebrate life with people who are struggling or hurting or who have been through the various aspects that comes along with either dealing with an addiction yourself or having someone in your life who's also dealing with these issues?
I think for me, you know, in my own walk, in my own life, you know, alcohol certainly has posed a lot of difficulties. And I gave up drinking a little over 3.5 years ago. And, you know, I wonder what took me so long. But the point is that there is another world, and there is another way of existing that is fantastic without that aspect in my life. And the number of people that I know that have struggled under the weight of addiction and continue to do so, and the folks that love them who can, you know, continue to struggle along with them, is just beyond counting. Every family that I know is touched by it in some way. And so just participating in something, taking some music into a situation where we really are celebrating the hopeful side, the other side, that new leaf that you turn over and what you see and how your relationships change. I can't celebrate that enough. So I'm happy to be in on that.
Well said, William.
Well, thank you, Gregory.
Well, for me, I've been in recovery now for, many a 24 hour, as they say. And I'm just very grateful that my road was as miraculous as it was, in terms of I didn't have many times off and on. I mean, once I made the decision and reached out for help, that was the end for me. And I work at it. You know, it's not something that just happens once. You keep at it for a lifetime. And with an event like this, I think not only does it draw attention to people like myself and Willie, is like, hey, there is a better way, and you can play music and enjoy music without the obligatory substance factor being as seemingly traditionally part of that experience.
Did you both feel that pressure when you were?
Well, I know for me personally, I felt that kind of a joint field of study in terms of music was also being a seasoned debaucherist. Mm-hmm. And I worked at it with great aplomb, shall we say.
A seasoned debaucherist.
And
next album title.
And I, as I said, I was very, very fortunate. But I also know I've had personal experiences with people that I know very close to me that have had experiences that it hasn't gone so well. And to know that there's a resource like this is unbelievable, because you're alone when, you know, if you're a parent or the person themselves and you reach out for it, you find out in a hurry that the alternatives are few and extraordinarily pricey, and it's just, it's horrific. So to know that there's something like this available is, you know, massive. And so whatever little thing we can do by playing this event to bring attention to it is all good.
So how did the three of you come to, or the two of you rather, come to know Peter and your Wiss Hope and get involved this way?
Yeah, I met Peter through one of my lifetime friends, Rob McCready, who works with Peter now. And Rob's just a bright light and a guy who's made big changes in his life and really embraced sobriety and also helping those who struggle. And he said, you got to meet my buddy Peter. And that was it. And we've been pals.
Excellent. Well, you can't have music without emotion, without the stories behind it. So let's have another song. What do we want to play?
This is a tune that is on a record I made with Carmen Nickerson called Bonfire to Ash. And, you know, I'd been sort of, pondering the idea of not drinking anymore. And it had reached a certain point where it was just untenable for me. And so I sort of wrote this song as a letter to myself, to my better self. And Carm heard it and she said, that's really great. We just need to write a bridge for it. And so we did. And but this song, it just sort of shows you there's another side. So it's called Sign.
All these habits creatures they keep, we're all slaves to potions, slaves to sleep. When I wake up I wanna dance a jig, uncork the poison and take a swig. If it's love you want, I'll give you some, but don't take it girl, then turn it. Cause the morning light against your face is the prettiest sign I've seen of grace. Prettiest sign I've seen of grace. Help me out, I'm falling. Pick me up, the wild wind's calling. There's still time to feel something. All these fables and all these facts, I could try to run but they pull me back. Though the lines across my face are real, I got a brand new heart gonna crack the seal. If it's love you want, I'll give you some, but don't take it girl, then turn and run. Cause the morning light against your face is the prettiest sign I've seen in grace. Prettiest sign I've seen in grace. Help me out, I'm falling. Pick me up, the wild wind's calling. There's still time to feel something. Honey, I do believe in you. I do believe. I do believe in you. I do believe. Oh, whippoorwill, don't let go of me. I hear your song across the breeze. If you have seen, but I believe. Show yourself to me. Mm-hmm. out. I'm falling, pick me up. The wild wind's calling. There's still time to feel something that's true. Honey, I do believe.
Willie Porter and Greg Koch performing in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. That was amazing, guys.
Thank you so
much.
Well
done.
Greg Koch over there on that sugar tickling guitar action.
Sugar tickler.
What's going on with
that?
I
got a t-shirt made. Behold, the sugar tickler.
A season's voucher.
Oh. Well, in the probably not the best transition on the note of season debauchery, you guys were mentioning on your various journeys when you were deciding to take the right path to get clean and focus on yourselves and a new lifestyle. Greg, you mentioned, you know, they were expensive options, not readily available, a lot of research probably on your own time. And Peter, part of Wiss Hope and that initiative is a new one-stop website that can help people find and connect with local health resources within Wisconsin. And it seems like a pretty simple concept. I'm surprised it hasn't been done before. So, you know, I'm sure you just observed through your journey and you trying to help other people that it's hard to wrangle and connect them. So how did you come to be able to connect all of these in one place?
Sure. We took a long time.
Yeah. How long did it take?
It took about a year and a half. So okay. We would simply just call. And if they don't answer and we're able to verify. So there's basic things that we're looking for because we're experienced people going through the systems and know what's needed at this point, right? So how can we help people get to that that point from A to B as quickly as possible and find out what's available and what other direction if they're really looking for some sort of help, what they can do? Yeah, so we took a long time and one young man named Jason sat on those phones for a good year and a half. Wasn't too happy about it, but he did.
Well, ultimately, I imagine it's incredibly helpful for someone who needs the help. And if they had this roadblock of needing to call themselves, to reach out, to get turned around in various places, that could inhibit someone's recovery.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the, like, how can we break down the barriers? What's the barriers to somebody finding? If they're in that space, that moment, because that moment can change pretty quickly, right? So we want to take those moments in someone's life to be able to make that connection. And what they do with it is up to them, but at least we're connecting them, right?
And Willie and Greg, what have you guys noticed when it comes to changes in the way people can reach out and get help? Or have you, you know, outside of being involved with Wiss Hope, do you take the initiative in your own lives to help people who are, you know, who disclose to you, like, hey, I think I need some help on this front. You mm-hmm. know, you have the experience. Can you lend an ear or lend a hand?
Well, typically, it kind of comes organically just from, you know, I travel quite a bit and you're involved in, like, communal feasts and whatnot. And people go, hey, you want a drink? And my usual response is, I don't drink anymore. It makes me break out in handcuffs. And that usually kind of disarms the experience for a moment. But then somebody will come up to me and go, well, do you go, you know, ask me a little bit more about it. And then I have no problem talking about it. You know, it's been an interesting thing. Again, being a musician, the perception is that, you know, there's this party aspect and so on and so forth. So I just try to really kind of put myself out there as someone who makes it known that I don't use. Of course, you know, you may, the anonymity thing in terms of the modality of that needs to be respected. But I have no problem dealing with people on a one-on-one basis in terms of, you know, what I've done and what's worked for me and so on and so forth. So mine is more kind of, I don't kind of hang my shingle out other than on an individual basis. But when I can be involved in stuff like this, which, you know, I believe is such an important resource, especially in this day and age where it's just, it's pestilential, to be honest with you. So I don't know if I answered your question, but
no, I think
the coffee's
did.
Working.
How about you, Willie?
For me, I've just, you know, I'm newer to it. So 3.5 years to not be drinking or engaging in that is relatively new for me. But people have approached me because I do I do talk about it a bit on stage, and I really enjoy the community of people that are trying to become better, to thine own self be true, in that sort of walk. A friend of mine asked me one time, we were sitting around, and they said, if you could be anybody, who would you be? And I said, without blinking, I said, well, I'd love to be a sober Jerry Garcia. And we both laughed.
Or a unicorn.
Exactly. But then it ultimately came back to, well, you just want to be the better version of yourself. So if you could sort of merge Darwinian thought with Abraham Maslow in your lifetime, what would that look like? So your own personal evolution towards being more honest with yourself and more accountable to those you care about is really what it's about for me. So I try to just walk that, and this is probably the most I've ever talked about it. So,
well, we appreciate you sharing.
Yeah, it's all good.
Peter, with the Wis Hope Festival, how do you see this event affecting or bringing change in the community?
I mean, my thought around it is if you're in the trenches, you're experiencing the heartbreaks all the time. So there's they call it burnout fatigue or, compassion fatigue, things like that. So for me, I walk the path every day in the families and with the people, and you're ending up at funerals. And these days, it's really increased so much that to bring a day of joy and invite those family members, invite the communities to take that time to celebrate what is, what we have, it feels right. Should I say the number again?
Yes, please.
844 Wis Hope.
All right. And with that, let's close with one last song.
Greg, what do you have for us?
Why don't we just noodle a little bit?
I love that.
Key of E, the people's key.
Peter Brunzell is the executive director at Wis Hope, and he was joined in the Lake Effect Performance Studio by musicians Willie Porter and Greg Koch, who'll perform at the first Hope Festival. That festival will be held at the Carroll College Shattuck Auditorium tomorrow evening, and you can listen to all the songs that Koch and Porter played for us and find out more about Wis Hope and the Hope Festival at WUWM.com. And that is the Friday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Mitch Tyke, Joy Powers, and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Maddie Andre, Zoe Munson, and Allison Dukanovich. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Emily Files this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.